Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm Hemant Mehta, and I'm flying solo today. You're listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. You can now listen to all of our episodes and see show notes at FriendlyAtheistPodcast.com. By the way, we now have a merchandise shop on the website, so if you want your podcast swag, and you know you do, go to our website and click on the store tab. John W. Loftus should be a Christian. He attended and graduated from Great Lakes Christian College, Lincoln Christian University, and Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where he learned under apologist William Lane Craig. So he knows Christianity very, very well. But he spent the last several years debunking the faith. His numerous books include Why I Rejected Christianity, Why I Became an Atheist, and The Outsider Test for Faith. His latest book is, strangely, called How to Defend the Christian Faith. So, John, thanks for being with me. And, okay, I'll bite. Why are you giving advice now to the other side?
Well, it's good to be on the program here. I need to say, first off, well, I decided that it would be provocative.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, an atheist writing how here's how you defend Christianity sounds intriguing. What exactly are you trying to do?
Yeah, and I do it so sincerely. It's just that, you know, if you read through the book, you'll find that in order to defend the Christian faith, you have to sacrifice your intellect to do that, I think, you know. But it is provocative in the same sense that I play billiards. I play 8-ball and 9-ball. And players like to teach other players how to play better pool. And we do that generously and willingly because we want the competition to rise, you know, and as the competition gets better, so do we get better, you know, those of us who are teaching the young beginners. And so I want to, you know, teach them how to do it right. And at the same time, by doing so, they will find it's you know, an impossible task, if you will.
What are the biggest... So you're someone who's debated a lot of Christians over the years. So you know exactly the arguments they use. You know which ones are really silly and maybe which ones could trip you up. What do you think are the... I guess, what do you think are the biggest things they should be doing that they're not? If they want to defend Christianity... is there any legitimate way for them to do it? Is there anything that you're like, yeah, I don't have a response to that one?
Well, repeatedly through the book, I'll say you should do what recognized apologists are doing if you're going to do it right. And then I show how these apologists are defending the faith, and I also dismantle their arguments in the process. And I say, well, but if you were to follow their lead and they know how to do it, then they're not doing it right. And you should, you know, come up with a better argument. You should realize this is faulty. And in some cases, I'll just say flat out that, you know, this is an intractable problem that you won't be able to solve. Good luck. so I want to teach them errors to avoid. Okay, that's one sense of what I'm doing. It's, you know, they need to know, well, if I'm going to be a good Christian apologist, then let me have a good sparring opponent. And that sparring opponent won't let me get away with any fluff, won't let me get away with saying things that are flat out wrong or contradictory. And I'm that opponent, at least I want to appear that way in the book, so that they can test their ideas out on me, and I'm trying to show them that those ideas aren't going to fly.
What are the biggest arguments that Christians make that just make you go, really? You're using that one? Like, what are the dumbest arguments that legitimate, like, apologists really do use?
Yeah. Well, the one that I call asinine,
yeah,
that does bother me the most is this idea that as an atheist, I can't use an argument against, faith in God from the problem of suffering without a moral standard to do so. You know, who am I to say that this problem, the problem of evil, undercuts the belief in a good God when I don't have a standard myself?
You can't say the Holocaust was bad because where are you judging what's bad from?
Yeah, that's the most asinine one because the argument speaks for itself. It doesn't matter who makes the argument. You know, you could be you could follow voodoo, you could be a Hindu, you know, you could be any sort of belief system you want, and you can still ask for the internal consistency of someone who says they believe in a perfectly good, all-powerful, and all-knowing being. And it doesn't matter what the belief is of the guy making that argument. The argument speaks for itself, and that's why I call it asinine. Now, we do have a problem, with morality, and we can answer that problem, but what we're doing is we're just saying, well, here's a problem for you. Don't skirt it by throwing it back on us. Deal with it.
So you're essentially saying, look, in your book, you're saying, here's the argument you make. I already have a response to that. All atheists have this response to it. So don't make that argument, because I'm already giving you my rebuttal right away. Do something better than that, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I do that in part two and part three of the book. Like chapter titles for part two are these. You must specialize in special pleading.
Say that again. Right. Specialize in special what?
You must specialize in special pleading. That's pleading a special case for your faith rather than treating all faiths, from the same standards.
Yes.
Just calling having double standards. Another chapter is you must punt to possibilities. another one is you must gerrymander for God.
What does that mean?
Another one
that you must gerrymander for God.
That's what politicians do.
Right.
They redistrict, states to get their, their representatives,
Right. This is an entirely Republican district, even though it looks like the weirdest shape you've ever seen. How does that apply to God?
Another chapter is you must master the art of mischaracterization. And the final one in part two is when all else fails, lie.
Wait, explain to me again. How does the gerrymandering for God work? What exactly are they doing?
Things like defining a problem away. They will spend a lot of time in what I call definitional apologetics. And they will require us to have a definition of an extraordinary claim. Well, what is an extraordinary claim? And let's define that.
So they're basically rewriting the rules to benefit them and try to trip you up, and that's not really fair.
And what I do, what I like to do is I like to focus on concrete examples like a virgin birth, or a levitating person, a resurrection from the dead, or, turning water into wine. I like to talk in terms of concrete examples rather than get lost into the morass of those definitions, because it keeps us out of that. And we're talking about, how do you know that somebody rose from the dead? Let's discuss the evidence for that, especially in the ancient past. So they gerrymander like that, and in other ways as well.
Are there arguments?
Yeah,
please.
Yeah, but the first part of the book really offers some good, sincere advice. And I start off by telling them to understand what they're getting into. And so one of the first chapters is simply, here are some of the most important arguments you're going to have to deal with as an apologist. Like, science of evolution, when it comes to Adam and Eve and the implications for that. science of neurology and the idea that's becoming solidified every year that we don't have any free will, you know, and that really hinges on whether you can be saved from sin based on a free will choice, you know. So I talk about those kind of problems just to boot camp, if you will. Mm-hmm. Here's what you have to get in. Here's what you have to, you know, figure out sometime. And I just throw it all at them, like the hand in the kitchen sink.
So if you were in an ideal debate, what arguments or types of arguments would your opponent be making for Christianity where you're like, yes, this is the conversation we should be having?
Well, they have all kinds of tricks up their sleeve, and it's hard to know which one to call up, to mention here. But they like to say that the idea of the resurrection of Jesus is a special case, deserving special treatment out of the many ancient miracles that were claimed to have been, you know, performed by magic men. And they want to say that we have to treat that with different standards. Like, let's not take the total trustworthiness of the Bible in mind. Let's just focus on the fact that, oh, people say that he died on the cross. You know, people say that, he rose from the dead. And people say that they saw him afterwards. Let's just isolate those things out of the mix, and let's try to explain those facts. And then they try to explain them by the resurrection when we're not even there yet. I mean, I want to call into question the total trustworthiness of the Bible. I think that factors into what we're going to believe out of the Bible itself. And they want to exclude the total trustworthiness of the Bible and, beliefs like demons and inhabiting pigs and axe heads that float. You know, those are clearly relevant to the case for the resurrection and whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. So, you know, they have lots of tricks up their sleeve, and I highlight those things and dismantle them, you know, in the book.
What do you think is the most effective argument you can use to get someone to abandon their faith?
Well, I wrote a book on that. It's called The Outsider Test for Faith, and that is to treat your own faith the same as you reasonably treat the faiths that you reject. No double standards. You know, you hear a story of a magic man or, you know, a levitating guru or, Muhammad flew up to, in the heavens.
On a winged horse or something, you would just say, that's ridiculous. Well, now apply that standard to your faith.
Exactly. It's ridiculous. I mean, they need to, consider their own faith from the perspective of never having heard it before and see what they would get when they talk about a person who has a baby, you know, a star that, pointed down to a single house, in Bethlehem.
And this is an argument we've heard before. If you took away childhood indoctrination, if someone had no idea about Christian mythology and the first time they heard it was when they were like 35 years old and you were trying to tell them, let me tell you about a virgin birth, let me tell you about Jesus who died and was crucified and then came back to life 3 days later. Oh, and by the way, he's going to come back later on. You would pretty much laugh it off, but people don't do that because they're so used to those stories from birth.
Exactly. And if they were going to test those stories, you know, the same way they would test any of the other stories, they would come away thinking, well, there's not enough evidence to believe that. And then the only reason they, treat their own stories with more weight to them is simply and only because, you know, they were raised to believe that way.
So is that what did it for you? Because, again, I mentioned at the introduction, you went to these Christian schools growing up. I mean, you studied under the apologists. What is it that made you change your mind? How old were you when you changed your mind?
So around 40 years old, I think.
Okay, so what did it?
Yeah. Well, it's a conjunction of a lot of different things, but mainly I just studied the Bible. I mean, I was trained in Christian apologetics, and when I decided to get serious about my faith, and, you know, what I never did is I never reevaluated my faith from my youth until then. And so I argue that people who were raised to believe for once in their lives have got to just act like an adult and properly evaluate their faith, you know, from a skeptical viewpoint as an adult. Well, I did that at the age of 40. I don't know why it took me so long, but, you know, I just saw a lot of ugliness in the church and a lot of hypocrisy. And I had studied with the liberals, so I knew of the liberals. It's just I had rejected their ideas as a conservative. It's just it was time to, you know, reach out of my faith. And when I did, and I studied the Bible this time honestly, it's really hard to get that brain to treat the evidence honestly. You're just so brainwashed, indoctrinated, you know, to see it one way. I thought, well, let me just look at it as an outsider in a way, you know. And I just couldn't believe certain things. You know, like one thing that really stuck out on me was that it says that the sun, moon, and stars was created on the fourth day. And I really tried to finagle around that.
You know, because really the sun is a star, you mean? And they were treating it differently, or because God created light on day one and then created the sun days later?
Yeah, that's what it says. And that's what I tried to reconcile with my faith, with the science. And I just couldn't do it. And the only thing that made sense to me was that it's all myth. And so then I asked myself, well, what else is myth? And, well, what about a Samson and his hair? You know, what about a sun standing still? What about a man being swallowed by a fish or a universal flood? And I started examining them from the perspective of an outsider, from the perspective of someone who wanted to believe. I had a vested interest in believing, but wanted to be honest, too, about what I was reading. And one by one, like dominoes, they all fell. I mean, just one by one.
You studied under William Lane Craig, and I wonder if, you know, what has your communication with him been like over the years since you deconverted?
Well, he still has hopes for me.
Do you ever debate him?
That's what he's consistently told me, and I find that really odd. You know, that as of now, I've published seven books. I'm coming out with another one next year. And I mean, if anybody is blaspheming the Holy Spirit, you know, it would be me. So he's got to reconcile that with his own text in Matthew that talks about that thing.
Do you ever do debates against him?
No. I'd like to. Sure. He's a really good debater. And, you know, I suppose he'll probably win. I mean, you know, technically, yeah. He seems to win a lot of them, and I don't expect it to be any different with me. But I would be.
Is that on his presentation, though? He's just a good speaker. He's a good debater.
Well, on his presentation, but you know, I think he pledges with the facts as well. You know, debater's job is to win, and when he's in debate mode, it's to win. And I've caught him saying things that he shouldn't be, and some things that he ought to know better. He's just there to win. And, but the thing is, if I could debate him, I think people would be more acquainted with me and might get one of my books. And that's where I make my sustained case against Christianity.
Who is the best Christian debater out there right now?
Well, I think probably it's Bill Craig.
Okay.
You know, I don't know of anybody else. Yeah. He studied, doing debates in college. I think even in high school, he was doing debates in high school. So he's always participated in those kinds of tasks.
Let me ask you, shift gears for a second. It's very impressive how many books you've written, lengthy books. And like, these are not like kids' books. They go into a lot of depth in these fields. What is your process like for writing these books? Like, what do you do on a daily basis when you're writing?
You should see my office. I got books strewn everywhere and magazine articles. It's a mess as I'm writing. You don't really want to come in my office because everything looks like a mess, but I know where everything is and why I got it, where I've got it, and note cards abound. For instance, when it came to researching for The Witch Hunts, I would research into the best books, and I would get them and read them and compile together the best of what I read and write it down and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it again. So And I can do a pretty good job on topics that I hadn't done a lot of research on before, simply by, you know, the knowledge I have on which publishers are the good ones to get books and to read for research, and which authors are the best ones. And I just write it out, you know, the way I've got it, and write it again and write it again. I'm really passionate about this, as you know.
Yeah.
I think that I've been given some things in life here, and there's a lot of knowledge. And, you know, people say, well, why don't you just walk away and live life? And then, you know, maybe I will someday. But for now, I've got a lot of knowledge that I want to share. And otherwise, if I don't do that, then I'd be wasting what I know. And I really do think that Christianity is a delusion. I think people are indoctrinated and or brainwashed to believe. I think it causes harm, and I want to keep people away from it as best as possible. And I wish I could do it for other religions, but I just don't know them as well.
It sounds, I'm just listening to your process, it sounds like you don't really rely on the internet any that much. It sounds like you're doing it old school, here are the books I need, and I'll get my information from there. I mean, am I wrong on that? Is there a reason for that?
No, I did mention books because that's where you get a sustained argument. I mean, sound bites and paragraphs on a blog, you know, those are nice, and I do look at them. I do a lot of research online as well. I just failed to mention that. That's all.
Okay.
But I like sustained arguments, and from people who are knowledgeable and scholarly.
This is just a personal question, because I spend so much of my time on my blog, and I know a lot of people like you who really put all their efforts into their books. I mean, that's where you're spending the bulk of your time. Do you think there's a benefit or a drawback to focusing on books in an age when it seems like a lot of younger people, a lot of people who are religious or not, are almost moving away from books? Like, what are you doing to make sure your arguments are reaching maybe a different audience?
Well, I'm doing interviews like this.
Yeah.
You know, I have an audience, and it's people who like books, and maybe it's an older audience because of that, and I understand that. But for anyone who wants to read what I write or edit, to put together in an anthology, then they can in turn, you know, utilize that in, you know, videos and on blog posts and quotes on Facebook, you know. I put it out there for people who want to know. I do understand that, you know, what you said, people are doing more YouTube and stuff like that. It's just
I'm not saying you should like suddenly go on YouTube. That's a horrible idea.
Right. I know that. Yeah, I know that.
Okay.
I know that.
Which
it's just that I have a niche.
Yeah.
And when I'm done with it, I'm done with it.
Got it. What other atheist authors do you tend to read? Which ones really inspire you? Which ones are you like, I wish I could write like that person. I wish I could make an argument like that person.
Oh, lots of them, actually. But I did dedicate this book to four intellectual giants. And in the front page there, Hector Avalos. Oh. I love the man. He's a one-man demolition team when it comes to all things Christian. He's a friend, and you know, I love him, and I love what he does. I like Peter Bogosian. I like his idea of raising up the grassroots atheist movement to help believers realize they're pretending to know what they don't know when they claim to know with 100% certainty that their faith is true. And Jerry Coyne, he's just amazing, the most knowledgeable scientist out there, writing on a daily basis and just giving religious faith a beating at every turn. And David Eller, I think everybody ought to be reading David Eller's works. Just look him up on Amazon. He's just one of the most insightful atheists out there. He ought to be speaking at many, many conferences and workshops. His perspective is unique among most atheists. So those four I single out. All friends of mine, and the best of the best, in my opinion.
I don't want to get into anything controversial here, and I know this topic is controversial for some people, but all the names you mentioned and all the times I see Christian apologists debating, it's always men. And I'm just wondering, why is that? I mean, at least on the atheist side, how come I don't really see that many women doing what it is that you do, which is debunking these things? Because, you know, on the surface, it doesn't seem like there should be any reason on our side anyway. I'm sure there's a lot of cases we could make for, you know, on the Christian side. Here's their arguments for why women should be focusing on other things. But I don't get that. Is there a reason? Do you think that's changing? Are you familiar with women who are doing the sort of work you do?
I don't know, but I will tell you an experience I had with Louise Anthony. She is an atheist philosopher, and I had asked her to write a chapter for me in Christianity is Not a Great Book. And, you know, I told her what I was looking for, and I think it was on morality. And she wrote me a long little email, and I mean, I thought it was pretty generous of her to do that, as much as I admire her, and I do. She said, I'm more a feminist than I am a debunker. I think that was the essence of it. She was more interested in what religion does to women. And so she focused on women's issues, she said, than in debunking or going after religion itself. And I found that insightful. And I don't know, somebody ought to do a poll on that. How many other women feel the same? And I know that if I was a woman, I would be pretty upset with male patriarchy on all of its aspects. But
so let me paraphrase what you're saying here. Tell me if I'm getting this right. You're basically saying that the argument that she made was that, you know, when she's studying the Bible and she wants to argue against the Bible, she's focused not on like an esoteric issue like morality or something, but really how it affects women specifically.
Yeah, for her the issue is feminism, and you know I respect that, and you know she didn't want to write anything specifically about religion because her writings were going to be focused on you know feminism.
Sure,
you know,
she was an expert in kind of that particular niche of it, so that's what she wanted to focus on.
Exactly, and you know I don't know how many others think that way. I don't know somebody should write something up to do a little research project on that, but one of the things I do. In my books, is I'm trying to show that religion is bad precisely because that's my top priority, I think. The thing I dislike most about religion is what it does to women. And if I can, you know, debunk the religion, then the next thing that I think should fall into place, and all of a sudden these religionists, these former religionists, would all of a sudden see that women are valuable in and of themselves rather than, you know, pieces of meat or chattel.
Right.
So I have a different tax, you know, with when it comes to feminism, which I am a feminist as much as a male can be. But I do understand those who want to just attack, misogyny and sexism like Louise Anthony and others.
There's unfortunately plenty of material to work with for that.
Yeah.
I had one more question for you, which is, you know, you wrote two of the books that you wrote was, you know, Why I Rejected Christianity and also Why I Became an Atheist. Why are those different books?
One's a self-published book and one isn't. Okay. Why I Became an Atheist, second revision, is a published book. I sent a copy to Paul Kurtz and of my self-published book, and he emailed me back and said, I want to publish this, and so I will always be grateful for him and him doing that for me because he gave me my start.
Sure.
But why I Became an Atheist is the title that Prometheus and I worked out together for that particular book, the one that was previously self-published, but then I added to it.
So your personal case aside, do you think those are two different things, like why you would reject Christianity and why you would become an atheist? Are those two separate things, or are they just the same thing, differently focused?
Good question. For me, they're kind of the same thing. And the reason why is because once I rejected Christianity, I knew the standards for how I should evaluate a different religion. And then I just, you know, you say, why didn't you become a Buddhist after that or something different? Why didn't you go to the other religions? Well, I already rejected those religions. As a Christian, I rejected all other religions but Christianity. I had reasons why I rejected them, and many of those reasons were simply because they lacked evidence or they cause harm. And so then, having already come to that conclusion, when I rejected Christianity, well, then I didn't have anything else to believe at that point. And I found that those other religions were doubly faulty for the standards that I, put up to measure Christianity with. So it's, in a way, it's one and the same thing, because the reasons you use to reject Christianity are going to be the same reasons you use to reject all other religions, because they're all faith-based, religions.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, I will have a link to your new book, How to Defend the Christian Faith, which is written for atheists and anyone who's interested in trying to debate it from a Christian perspective. We'll have that link below. John W. Loftus, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. This episode was taped at Cinnamon Sound Studios in Aurora, Illinois. The music was composed by Brad Chagdis. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at patreon.com/Hemant. That's He-Man T. We appreciate your support. And if you have any questions, feel free to email us at friendlyatheistpodcast@gmail.com. I'm Hemant Mehta, and we hope you'll join us next time. Thank you.